Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Andrew Pulver. This week I meet director Tony Scott to find out about his latest adrenaline-pumped, action-packed movie, a remake, or is that a reworking, of the 70s subway hijack thriller The Taking of Pelham 123. And it's not quite Strictly Come Dancing, but this week sees the release of Rumba, a black comedy about love, dancing and memory loss. The dancing duo Fiona Gordon and Dominic Abel wrote, directed and play the lead roles in Rumba, and they'll be whirling and twirling their way around the Film Weekly studios later on. And I'll be reviewing the pick of this week's films with Peter Bradshaw, including Coco Avant Chanel starring Audrey Tautou. Yep, it's not a remake, it's the original version. It's Film Weekly.
Pelham 123, come in. This is Rail Control Center. Are you there?
Gerber, baby boy. What's up?
Garber, just wanted to let you know the mayor's been notified.
They gonna pay?
I don't know. I'm just the, what do you call me? The broker.
No. You represent the city of New York right now, buddy.
Well, I can tell you that you're dealing with one of the all-time bureaucracies. I know that. I mean, it takes time.
Well, you better fix the bureaucracy, because when the time comes, these hostages are going to go real quick.
So that was Denzel Washington as Walter Garber and John Travolta as Ryder. The Taking of Pelham 123 tells the story of a hijacked subway train in New York City. Denzel Washington plays the humble train worker who is sucked into the hostage crisis as an ad hoc negotiator. And John Travolta plays the mean career criminal caught up in a vortex of violence and revenge. Tony Scott is a big hitter of a director. His career is marked by huge success and dismal failure. From the hugely successful Top Gun and Enemy of the State, to box office flops like Days of Thunder and, most recently, Domino. When I met up with Tony Scott, I started out by suggesting that The Taking of Pelham 123 was, in many ways, a homage to the city of New York.
I've never really shot New York. I've shot bits and pieces, commercials and stuff. And it's a city I've always loved. I always wanted to capture that energy and show New York in a way that nobody else has shown it. And it was a very strong character in this movie for me. Right. And I think I gave New York a very different look.
Can I say something about the sort of filming style, really, which is, I always think of your film, being filled with this kind of manic energy. And I just wondered kind of how you keep it going, really, because, watching a film, you'd expect a sort of 25-year-old MTV guy to have made it. And who are, still doing this kind of ultra-high energy filmmaking.
65.
Beautiful.
I've got good drugs.
You look forward to it, yeah.
But the history of, in terms of what I've done with my life, I started off as a painter, 8 years in art school, and then I came through advertising and rock videos, and I've got ADD, so I just want to...
Well, literally.
I'm terrible. I can't let things sit, and I have this natural energy that I want to inject into what I do.
You've now worked with Denzel Washington for, I think this is the fourth time, isn't it? Can you talk a little about your relationship with him? I mean, it must, it's obviously been very productive for both of you.
I love working with Denzel because he does enormous amounts of homework. And then when he comes to playing his character, he can do nothing and give everything. He's insecure in the best possible way, trying to think, how can I make it better? But it's always constructive in terms of that. When you get that insecurity or that reaching for difference or reaching for making it better, it can become a destructive process, and a downward spiral. And my first movie with Denzel was on Crimson Tide with him and Gene Hackman. And him and Gene are very similar, very complex individuals, but they both let it all sit back inside and they can do that and give you everything. And in the four movies I've done, he's a very distinctly different human being.
Well, this one I read somewhere that you said he was based on an Albanian kind of character. Was that?
Yeah. Well, the guy I found was a retired MTA worker, 65-year-old Albanian. The guy next door, which is Denzel had one meeting. A guy called Ike, and sometimes it depends on the character. Sometimes it's a weak, in Man on Fire, I think Denzel was with Don, who's his role model. I think he spent 7 days with him.
How does your research team sort of operate and find, because you talk a lot about them finding these people. I mean, how does that actually go?
My right arm is, we used 28 years in the DEA, so he knows how to find people. He goes out and he interrogates and investigates. And so Don goes out and he goes and he investigates and
Is this the way you've always operated? I mean, say, looking back in the 80s, would you have made something like Top Gun the same way?
I think I was more driven by, I just come out of 10 years or 15 years in commercials, more driven by style and mood and camera moves and the haircuts. So I didn't, my process was a little more, I want to say painterly, I'd draw off my own imagination. You know, but then what really inspired my imagination were people, and the real people. And now I can't move without research, you know.
Way back when you started out, did you think that you were, I mean, did you plan to go into making what I would consider you a sort of specialist in the sort of major blockbuster kind of type of filmmaker? I mean, did you aim for that, or was that a kind of accident that was thrust upon you, if you see what I mean?
No, it was, when I say it was an accident, you know, I've just got to say that I've been lucky in that I've every movie that I've made has been a love affair with it, and some of them the end results have been good and some haven't been so good. They've all been wild rides. Yeah. And I started off with The Hunger. Do you ever see The Hunger?
Oh, yeah.
The Hunger, I got shredded. See, everybody hated it. Yeah. And I couldn't get arrested. Hollywood hated it.
Right.
It took me 4 more years, then I got Top Gun. And after Top Gun, I got pigeonholed to doing action movies, you know.
Mm.
And then I did True Romance, you know. So I checkerboard and mix and match. But I've never just done a movie for the sake of doing it, thank God, touch wood.
I mean, I am so though interested in, you know, you talk about your films with a very sort of single-minded vision as that's what you put into it. But when you have to make a film that, you know, has to be huge, how do you sort of personally cope with that kind of pressure, really?
I get off on the pressure.
Yeah.
So what I can do, as I said earlier, I'm perverse, I think. But there's nothing more frightening, there's nothing more exciting than the day of shooting. You know, so, and the bigger the day, the more I rise to the occasion, yeah? And I rise, and I think a lot of people in the business, directors are famous for being pricks when the pressure increases.
Yeah.
But I've worked with the same people, the same team for 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
I surround myself with what I call my extended family.
Right.
And I love what I do.
How does it feel when things don't go so well? Because obviously, you know, I presume you put the same huge energy and sense of responsibility into every film.
Mm.
And, you know, sometimes Enemy of the State, it's fantastic. Everything works. Everyone loves it. Other times it doesn't work so well. And I think you're on record as saying, you know, you fucked up Domino a bit. And so I'm just, you know, wondering what it feels personally to have gone through all that and yet sort of feel a bit lost at the end.
No, it's hard. It's like, it's hard. It's like having, you know, you're having a love affair because the love affair is for the duration of you making the movie and it falls apart. It's very hard. It's wounding. And as you say, I was quoted that I fucked up on Domino. I think it was more to do with the fact I love making. I haven't had a bad experience making a movie. I've also had a great experience, but they're like love affairs, and the end results sometimes be good and sometimes bad.
Mm.
That's a fact of life of anything that you do that's creative. It's not like being in banking. Nothing's black and white, you know?
Yeah.
And so you and everybody, Michael Bay.
I didn't bring it up specifically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They've had failures and they've had hits. You know, my brother, me, and you have rise and falls, and you never go out to have a fall. You go out to, you know, have a hit.
Thanks to Tony Scott there, and the taking of Pelham 123 is on UK wide release from this Friday, the 31st of July. And joining us to find out whether the taking of Pelham 123 is a hit or a miss is Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Welcome,
Hello.
Peter.
Hello there. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. We are going to be talking about the taking of Pelham 123, the film Rumba, and also Coquet Avant Chanel with Audrey Tautou. So let's start with the taking of Pelham 123. There have been many rumblings that it's a slightly unnecessary remake of a much loved classic. What's your feeling on the subject there?
Well, I suppose all remakes of much loved classics are A, unnecessary, and B, doomed to failure. And I suppose, in a sense, both of those two considerations apply in this case. I didn't dislike it as much as I thought I was going to. In fact, I was kind of amused by it and entertained by it. Tony Scott does what is on the tin with him, basically. He's madly overactive, madly macho, with an obsessive desire to cram in action. But having said all that, it's actually kind of funny and kind of entertaining.
I mean, one thing I can see about it, one of the reasons why I think it was sort of ripe for remake, if you like, is when you watch those sort of 70s films again,
especially in the early 70s, the grammar that they used to kind of describe action and what we would think of as very exciting scenarios, you sort of look at it now and you think, God, you know, it's so slow and laboured and the pace seems really odd. And with somebody like Tony Scott, who's a past master at just sort of quick cutting and injecting this kind of bravado into it, there is some rationale for doing it, I think.
Yeah. One thing he has lost is the idea of it being a gang working together and you kind of getting to know, not just getting to know the kidnap victims in the traditional kind of 70s disaster movie way about the victims, because this was part of a slew of basically disaster movies like Airport and Poseidon Adventure. This was kind of in that context, not just getting to know the people who are involved in the crisis, but also getting to know the gang themselves. And of course, famously, the gang had colour nicknames, brown and blue, etc., which is supposedly what inspired Quentin Tarantino. But that's completely lost.
Also, he loses the absolute classic final scene, the kind of Gesundheit line that Walter Matthau has. Interestingly, that is the final moment and the final sort of capture of the gang. And that's one of the sidekicks. It's not the main guy. The main guy gets sort of scooped up earlier, which again, you can see kind of why he might want to reorientate the action to sort of focus on the principal villain, Travolta.
Yeah, he wants a kind of face-off, head-to-head, in the classic kind of Michael Mann, good macho alpha male, bad alpha macho male, going kind of nose-to-nose in the film structure, whereas I seem to remember the original being much more diffuse than
it's
that.
It's much looser, yeah. I mean, what did you think of Travolta? I mean, I have to say, he really got on my nerves in this film. Really reminded me of Broken Arrow, which is also equally idiotic.
He's one of these male performers who, in middle age, has got these tics, these facial tics and mannerisms, and no power on earth will stop him from doing them. Basically, he does this. He compresses his lips together and flares his nostrils, indicating a kind of permanent, almost righteous disgust with everything that isn't him. Basically, and it is kind of annoying, really. I think, in a way, Travolta he kind of came back into our lives with Pulp Fiction, and Tarantino managed to kind of get him away from that, and then he kind of relapsed back into it again. As I say, yeah, you're right, he is fantastically annoying. But I do quite like Denzel Washington, who always manages to carry off every scene that he's in. He's stolid and interesting, and he has quite an interesting voice, kind of musical voice. So I don't know, for whatever reason, it didn't rub me up the wrong way that I thought it was going to.
Great. Okay, thank you very much. And now we'll turn to the film Rumba, and we'll be hearing from the writer-director stars of that film later on. Now, this was a very odd film. I actually found it pretty baffling for the first 10 minutes before I realised that we weren't going to get Strictly Ballroom. That this was going to be this completely different sort of film in which the dancing is actually not really the point. I know you like the film quite a lot.
So, I did.
Maybe see if you can describe it slightly and say kind of what it was that you found intriguing about it.
It is. It's the nearest way I can think of describing it is strictly Jacques Tati, basically. It looks like it's going to be sort of Strictly Ballroom, but in fact, it is a gentle comedy in the silent or semi-silent genre tradition of the great French comedy master Jacques Tati. I've also seen it compared to Buster Keaton, but I actually think the Tati comparison is much closer. It's a really nice, gentle little comedy about a, as I say, more or less semi-silent, with some dialogue, but more or less semi-silent, about a couple who are teachers. They're a married couple. They live for the weekends when they do these Latin American ballroom dancing, but a chance encounter with a would-be suicide on the street, I don't want to give it all away, but ends in crisis for them both. And I don't want to sound too pretentious about this, but the film tries to enact the kind of choreography of their lives, them trying to get back together again, the chaotic, broken clockwork quality of their choreographed lives. And what I liked about it was the gentleness of the humour, partly because so much comedy these days is so aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, I think the humour is the key point. I mean, it's something that's a very particular taste. It's a very doleful, kind of theatrically grotesque humour, where they just sort of, pull very weird faces and body shapes and fall over a lot in a sort of in a very subdued way. It's not frenetic at all. That's why I was always thinking the kind of Keaton comparisons are a bit strange, because those sort of films are really fizzing with stunts and energy, whereas the tattoo thing is much more appropriate, I think.
Much more laid back. It's basically very gentle, and it's about sympathy. It's inviting, the laughs are about sort of sympathising with the characters, basically. It didn't outstay its welcome. It was quite a brief film, which I think is, again, a very good thing. And it had sort of visual gags. It was really nice change of pace.
Great. And now for something completely different, a much more polished, conventional film. It's a biopic of Coco Chanel. It's called Coco Avant Chanel, or Coco Before Chanel, starring Audrey Tautou of Amélie fame.
Qu'est-ce que c'est que cette tenue? On veut savoir ce que tu as fait de la robe que je t'avais offerte.
Tu as pendu à la fenêtre. J'avais l'impression de porter tes rideaux.
C'est dommage. Tu ressemblais presque à une femme.
T'es déçu. On va croire que je te coûte pas cher.
So, Peter, the fashion industry is notoriously difficult to make films out of. I mean, I can't think of any really successful ones. Even Bruno didn't really grapple with the fashion industry particularly.
No, it didn't.
And it is the graveyard of filmmakers, I always think. I think that this one sort of managed to pull it off to a certain extent, again, by not really grappling too much with the fashion industry itself.
What I found was a bit interesting about it is that it talked about effectively the prehistory of the fashion industry. As it says in the title, it's Coco before Chanel. It's before she became this fashion legend. And it quite interestingly tries to tell you what were the emotional determinant forces behind her design ideas, and perhaps the whole concept of fashion itself. Is it designed to please women? Is it designed to please men? What is it about? And to try to trace the origins of all that in Coco Chanel's early life.
I mean, the big theme in the film seemed to be suggesting that it was about kind of liberation in some way, that it started off with these very kind of constricting empire fashions, and that it was all about getting rid of the corset, basically.
Yes, exactly so. She, Coco Chanel, is always noticing how constricted and uncomfortable women's clothing was, fashionable women's clothing, and most of all how absurd it was with its frills and feathers and furbelows and all the rest of it. And she herself, although she wasn't necessarily imposing this on other people as a young woman, she affected a very gamine, boyish style herself, which flirted on the edges, the film implies, of homosexuality, and her kind of gay flirtations with this fashionable actress, Emilienne d'Alençon, played by Emmanuel Devos, who is so important in popularising her designs. There's also another big advantage to the film, as far as the filmmakers are concerned, in concentrating only on Coco Chanel's early life, is that it steers well clear of the Second World War.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which was a real problem, I don't know if you remember, for the Edith Piaf movie.
Right, yeah.
I mean,
which
twisted itself up in knots, trying not to, in Basil Fawlty's words, mention the war, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
Because,
Of course, we should say that Chanel had
Coco
a lot of
Chanel
problems with being
was criticised for an apparent liaison with a high-ranking German officer who appeared to get her privileges and status in Nazi-occupied Paris, and it was something for which she was never entirely forgiven in Europe.
Audrey Tautou has sort of struggled a bit outside of the film she made.
Yeah, she has. Apart from after Amélie
and Very Long Engagement. I don't think she's really sort of nailed anything particularly brilliantly until now. I mean,
she really did show that she had the chops, basically, as they say. I mean, this was a very mature, complex role. She wasn't playing the kind of simpering, spaniel-eyed kind of ingenue anymore that she did with Amélie and A Very Long Engagement, which is basically, as a friend of mine says, Amélie with shrapnel, basically. she'd really grown up, actually, and that's a good thing and a bad thing, because it's a good thing because it showed that what a good actress she is and what a terrific performance she gave. But it's also frustrating because I really wanted to see how she would tackle the mature years of Chanel, you know.
And there's that very short scene at the end where she's sort of sitting world-weary on the steps.
Yes, a rather sugary montage showing her presiding over these kind of models and showing that she, in effect, interestingly, kind of invented the theatre of fashion. She sort of invented this business, this runway catwalk traditions and all the rest of it. She kind of invented it all without knowing that she'd invented it.
Great. On that note, say thank you, Peter. Thanks for coming in. A big thanks there to Peter Bradshaw, and you can read all of Peter's reviews and more by going to guardian.co.uk/film.
My dog likes rice.
My dog likes rice.
My dog likes spicy rice.
My dog likes spicy rice.
My dog smiles when he sees rice.
My dog smiles when he sees rice.
For miles and miles, my dog smells rice.
For miles and miles, my dog smells rice.
He cries when he has no rice.
He cries when he has no rice.
Around and round his ration of rice, my dog rowdily runs.
That was a clip from the film Rumba, and one of the few scenes that involve actual words, because what we have is a film almost entirely devoted to physical comedy. And we're joined in the studio by the two stars, Dominic Abel and Fiona Gordon. So welcome to the Film Weekly studio, Dominic and Fiona. And just to make it a little easier for everybody, we'd just like to ask you really to describe your film, because it is a very visual film that sort of doesn't necessarily translate too well into audio clips.
Well, describing our film is probably a little bit like having to describe a dance, but we won't do what Abbas Kiarostami does and say that we don't like to talk about film. we have our film is about a very happy couple who have a passion. The passion is dance, and they have a terrible accident which deprives them of their reason for life, their passion, dance. And little by little, everything goes downhill until they lose almost everything that sort of materializes their happiness. And the idea of that was to see what's left underneath when you lose everything. That's what the story is about.
It's a little bit like you eat an artichoke. You pull off the leaves, and you wonder if the heart, what the taste of the heart will be.
Obviously, those are the bare bones of the story, but there's a lot more to your film than that. Everybody that's written or said anything about the film compares it to Jacques Tati. So I'm interested to know if that was deliberate and how you conceive of your kind of comic style, really.
It's not deliberate, and we're embarrassed by the comparison, because for us, of course, he's a grand artist. But we feel like we're part of a kind of a physical comedy family, including the greatest, who have influenced us immensely, like Chaplin and Keaton and Linder and Laurel and Hardy, and well, there are tons of them. And some of the musical artists that are less well known, like George Carl. Yeah, I think people think of Tati because he was a modern clown. At a period where clown was sort of disappearing, where physical comedy on film was disappearing. So it's an example that automatically comes to mind.
I mean, I have to say, when I first started watching the film, I was a bit baffled by it, because I kind of assumed it would be a sort of strictly ballroom type of thing where there'd be, you know, lots of people dancing, you know, learning to love through Cuban dance. And then I obviously realised, having read the notes, that you went to the Lecoq School because I've had lots of friends a number of friends who went to Lecoq, so I sort of know what you're talking about is very much what he teaches. So I'd just be interested for you to talk a little bit about how you brought that style into filmmaking, which is not an obvious match.
We are coming from the stage, but right from the beginning we wanted to be funny. In a way, we didn't choose it. We are clowns. And so we were inspired by clowns from the cinema, more than clowns from the stage or from the circus. And we learned a lot at that school, Lecoq, because we improvised a lot. We never started from a text. We started from simple ideas and improvised. And we were used to create. Every week we had to create a show and present it to the other students. And so when we came out of the school, it was natural for us to start from the scratch, yeah. And so we invented our own way to tell a story. And when we came to cinema, That's what we always wanted to do, but we took time. We didn't lose that essential part of theater, which is the complicity between us and the audience, simplicity, playing with like kids, with storytelling convention, with a kind of poverty that you have on the stage. Because in cinema you have access to real life, to real places, to editing, so you can pretend that it's real. When you are on stage, it's more like reading a book. You have the audience have to fill the holes with their imagination. We use a little branch to pretend that you are in the forest. You use a sheet to pretend that you are in the sea. And we found the beauty of that creative part is everything for us. And when we came to cinema, we wanted to bring that, our specialty, to bring that. Of course, we learn about cinema and we use the technique, but we are always looking for that fragility, human fragility, even in the special effects.
How did it work directing ourselves? I mean, obviously, there was a third person who was involved as well, but yeah. Did you argue a lot? Or?
We always work collectively, two or three. When you are two, sometimes we fight, and so you don't know who's going to decide. When you are three, it's sometimes easier. But we didn't choose it. It was natural for us.
Often when we write the script, we argue a lot. But once we start improvising and then watching our filmed improvisations, we're very quickly together. Either we all think it's lousy or we all think it's great or it's easy.
I have to say, as a final sort of point, which I actually once did a workshop with Lecoq myself.
And yes.
I'm not an actor, and I've had a kind of awful, you know, hideous kind of ordeal to do that thing you're talking about, having to sort of do an improvisation in front of everybody else. It's horrific. Anyway, so congratulations on the film and congratulations on coming through Lecoq unscathed. So thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you, Andrew. Right.
Well, a big thank you there to Fiona and Dominique, and their film Rumba is screening at selected cinemas from this Friday, the 31st of July. The music featured in this week's edition is from The Taking of Pelham 123 by David Shire, the original score, of course, and this is what the remake score sounds like. Yep, that's what we thought. And don't forget, of course, to pick up this Friday's Guardian with the film and music section in it. But for now, from me, Andrew Pulver, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.